Take a network break. Enjoy a virtual donut and caffeinated beverage as we dash through this week's tech news. We've got new micro-segmentation offering from Arista, AI enhancements from Fortinet and Versa Networks, funding requests from the FCC, and more. We're sponsored today by Palo Alto Networks. Your branches change, your SD-WAN should too. Palo Alto Networks wants to show you how AI and ML are powering next-gen SD-WAN and SASE for the branch. SDX Central and Palo Alto Networks hosted an exclusive online event that shows you how next-gen SD-WAN and SASE can help you modernize and secure your branches. Go to sdxcentral.com to get the free link to this event replay or see the show notes for Network Break episode 477. After the news, we have a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation about network monitoring with sponsor NetBees. Monitoring's getting increasingly complicated by distributed workers and distributed applications, and when that trouble ticket comes in, you need good data and the right data to diagnose and solve problems. NetBees offers products for real-time network performance monitoring for the campus, the WAN, Wi-Fi, and end users. All right, let's dive into the news. Arista has announced a new micro-segmentation capability. It's using Arista switches and its CloudVision management platform to create and enforce rules about which devices, users, and apps can communicate. The goal is to create zero-trust micro-segmentation without the need for endpoint software or host-based agents. Arista is targeting campus data center and remote access use cases.
Well, the first thing I noticed about this announcement is one of the things that we poked fun at Arista for before, it's always got to come up with its own term for something that every other company is doing. And of course, this week it's micro-segmentation, which they call, drum roll please, micro-perimeter.
I did see that, yes.
Yes. Okay. The only thing missing is a trademark. Quite often they trademark those. I do like to poke fun at that because I think it's an amusing little characteristic about Arista.
Yes.
I think when I read this announcement, and you took the briefing, Drew, so I'll let you dive into the details here, but this whole thing strikes me as a somewhat of a reaction to what Cisco's been doing with its software-defined campus and its Cisco, what they call SDA, software-defined access, which is where they've been in the campus doing security and selling a lot of that stuff, like literal billions of upgrades into people with Cisco campuses. And, you know, it's all been based loosely around security group tags and zero trust tools, which they got with. And they kind of got there first. It's one of the few areas where Cisco made a really good set of decisions about how to capture that market. And it was one that none of its competitors was really serious about. Everybody was just sort of like, yeah, campus, we're kind of, you know, everybody's not doing it. And then Cisco came along and sort of took it on. And then I think, you know, it's really about how does Arista now react to that? Does that make sense? Is that, you know, what's in the details of this announcement?
I think it does make sense. And we are seeing a lot of interest in micro segmentation. It's been bubbling up as the notion of zero trust sort of takes hold of the network and security industry. And one of the ways to move towards micro zero trust is via micro segmentation. So the way Arista is doing it, they're getting first, you obviously need to have information about users and devices. So Arista is getting that from third party sources like NAC systems, Radius, IPAM, and identity stores. They also have their own NAC. Arista has a NAC and an NDR that they can also access, but they can get it from third party providers. That information goes up into CloudVision, which is their management platform. The systems also, the switches from Arista are actually mirroring network traffic and sending it to an on-prem appliance that you have to buy if you want to use the solution. This appliance then analyzes that traffic and sends IP fix records to CloudVision. So CloudVision then combines all of the network data and all of the device and identity data, maps all these communication patterns, sees who's talking to what and how, and suggests access rules. Engineers can then tweak those rules before putting them into place. Once the rules are set, CloudVision writes them to a database in Arista switches, and as packets pass through the switch does a database lookup and matches a rule to a packet. Arista says there's no latency penalty in the lookups because they're essentially using a sort of tag-based mechanism like security group tags to associate devices and IP addresses in a tag and then applying a rule based on the tag associated with those devices.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like Cisco's security group tags, which is the obvious way to do it, right? If you're using ASICs in the campus switch, creating a proprietary tag, modern campus switches can easily handle MPLS. But the general sense I have in the industry is that putting BGP in MPLS or using some sort of tag distribution protocol in the campus, they don't. I think there's a sort of a belief that MPLS is secret magic upsell business that you can extract a lot of revenue for, ignoring the fact that, you know, BGP and MPLS has now been around for going on 30 years, right? It was originally tag switching from the mid-1990s. But I think the vendors still believe they can upsell that and say, you can't get that in the cheap stuff. So when they come to the campus, in the modern campus ASICs, you've got huge tables, huge CAM tables that you can load entries into, BCAM and TCAM, especially with the latest Broadcom campus ASICs and also the Marvel campus ASICs. So what it really feels like to me is, do you remember back in 2010, Drew, we were talking about OpenFlow? And this idea that we would calculate all the flows in the network and then put rules in the switches. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, yes. And then you had a controller that was supposed to program the switches according to those rules, yes. I think Arista would run screaming at that comparison. this is not flow-based. No, and there is no controller programming your switches. No. They're just programming a database in the switch. So I see the comparison, but Arista would definitely raise its hackles. It's not that.
I would say it is, right? It can't just be like this MAC address or, you know, this source MAC address or this TCP IP destination. This has to be a flow in some way. Now, I do remember back in the day, everybody saying OpenFlow will never be able to do this. And, you know, because that came out around about just after the first SDN started to be discussed around 2012. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about SDN in 2010. And then in 2012, OpenFlow came along and sort of gave us a structure around which to hang. And then everybody in 2013 said, oh, no, OpenFlow is not going to work. It just doesn't scale or it's not possible. I said, look, it's just a matter of time until the ASICs get there. And I think what we're seeing here is that this is what, in my view, this is what Arista's doing, except they're taking it to the logical extension is, if you're going to define flows, the question is, what flows are you going to treat as useful or interesting? And in this case, they're saying, well, if we take all of the security data, you know, as you say, NAC, RADIUS, IPAM, Zero Trust, whatever the hell it is, and extract a set of flow rules that you then push down into the ASIC, That's the SDN vision from 2010, 2012, in my view.
Yes, although I will say, ask specifically, are you doing these actions based on flows? They said, no, it's a per packet lookup. Every packet that runs through Arista does a lookup on these rules to see what the disposition of that packet should be, allow or deny, essentially, or redirect somewhere else.
That's what OpenFlow did. Every packet gets looked up.
That's true. Like,
when a packet or a frame goes through a switch, it gets looked up, right? So anyway. Yeah, I mean, we might be splitting hairs, but I think this is very useful because this whole micro-segmentation idea, the prevention of lateral movement inside, and then, as you pointed out, you know, combining this with authentication, you know, IP addresses. Should this IP address be on this VLAN? Should this MAC address be on this VLAN? You know, that type of stuff, and then continuously analyzing it to make sure that the context in which that device sits on the campus, is it suddenly accessing something that it shouldn't. That is a change in the way that we approach campus security. It's been, you know, I think Aruba's doing something similar. I haven't followed what Extreme's doing in the campus space because it's, you know, they're mostly fairly just holding on to what they've got at the moment. But I think micro-segmentation is what we've always wanted. And what I think is here is that Arista's very late to this. It should have done this a couple of years ago, as soon as it became obvious that Cisco was getting real traction. Of course, Cisco, you know, Arista's really been making its money elsewhere. So maybe it had to wait till now for, you know, the limited resources perhaps that they were allocating to this to do its thing.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that Arista has never been, you know, an innovator pushing new ideas. They tend to be a fast follower. I think that's the case here. They've let sort of the market develop around micro-segmentation. Folks like NSX, VMware NSX, we're talking about this a long time ago. Illumio is another one that plays in this space. They have a different approach. We also talked about Cisco Hypershield and Zscaler getting into micro-segmentation. Cisco's relying on software agents pushed as close to workloads as possible to do the enforcement. The Zscaler air gap, they're using fingerprinting of devices and then a gateway to enforce access rules. So Arista, you know, has the switches, it has CloudVision, it can use those assets to do a different version of micro-segmentation without the need for software agents or endpoint agents, which I think there's trade-offs of each approach. And Arista being a switching company saying, well, we'll just leverage the resources we have. I think it's a smart play for them. But yes, I agree they are. I wouldn't say they're late to the market. I say they're coming in at the right time when there's a lot of interest in zero trust and micro-segmentation. But they are definitely not a pioneer here for sure.
Yeah, I would say they're late. I think Cisco's made hay. I mean, they've hoovered up a lot of their business in this space already.
Potentially in the campus, yeah. But Arista also, again, they sort of flirt with the campus, but maybe this is more of an effort to actually try to stake out a position there.
Yeah, if you're a campus or networking person, you might regret that AI networking came along to sort of disrupt the investment flow into what was the enterprise campus. And Cisco's done well out of that. You know, they don't, because everybody else suddenly jumped onto AI networking, and Arista's been so heavily linked with the big clouds, like the mega clouds, and supplying them with, you know, high-end routers and now AI networking and all that sort of stuff. Although I must say their share, they investor presentation this week, recently, they sort of suffered a bit of a fall because investors sort of took the presentation to say that AI networking is not really where Arista's at. And there was sort of a view that NVIDIA's got a better AI networking portfolio than Arista does. And there was a bit of an over-rotation into thinking that Arista would get more sales because it had a, you know, customers were going to buy more Arista switches to be able to do AI. And then it became clear that NVIDIA was hoovering up most of that market in the short term. And then, of course, people have turned around. So sentiment keeps wobbling around inside of the market. I think there's an increasing amount of nervousness around the tech stocks. People are sort of beginning to think like, you know, really these companies are overvalued, but when does the train stop? When does the gravy ride? You know, does AI boost these companies for the long term? Is this a growth cycle that continues for years and years, or is this just a temporary thing? And I think the prevailing view around AI is that this is a temporary spike to infrastructure, but it's not a sustaining one that lasts for very long. So Arista's got to start looking at getting back to the campus to be able to say to companies, we've got a growth strategy that's not just dependent on AI networking. And I think we'll see more of this in the weeks ahead as the companies sort of say, look, AI is going to be a long time coming. It's not going to change everything overnight. There's a couple of specialist early companies in the market like NVIDIA and so forth that are doing the infrastructure for this, but companies aren't, you know, spending tens of billions on AI infrastructure. They're spending small amounts, test amounts, and where possible, they're spending it on someone else's cloud to try and work out if there's anything there before they commit to buying, you know, huge amounts of hardware to put on-prem.
Yeah, I guess I would say in regard to building out AI infrastructure, I would think Arista is well positioned for that because they have ties with the big cloud giants that are building out, you know, all these Gen AI platforms that do require a lot of infrastructure gear. And Arista's got, I think, a competitive platform there.
But they're also dependent on Broadcom, of course, right?
Of course.
Or Marvell.
Yep.
You know, generally, they're whoever their campus silicon supplier is, I can't recall. I don't think it's Broadcom.
But, I mean, anybody not doing InfiniBand is dependent on Broadcom to get a piece of that AI infrastructure if you're selling Ethernet switches. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, Cisco's still got Silicon One, but whether they're going to, you know, re-spin Silicon One to support that. And we still don't know what AI Ethernet's going to look like. You know, they're going to say, we need some sort of XPU, you know, Are we going to put an AI processor in the switch to be able to use AI on the switch to groom traffic flows? Or are we going to put that in the DPU? And then you have the situation where Cisco doesn't have a DPU, so it might want to promote the XPU vision, and Broadcom wants to promote the XPU vision, because I don't feel like Broadcom's got a strong position in DPUs at this particular point in time. They've got certainly a strong position in NICs and perhaps even smart NICs, but Intel and AMD and obviously NVIDIA are really leading in that DPU space.
Yeah.
And all three of them are making substantial commitments, financial commitments to grow that. And, you know, so if you're Arista, you know, in the executive ranks, looking at where your future growth comes from, you might be saying, time to turn back to the campus because we know that AI is going to be a slow burn. You know,
yeah.
Do enterprises want to run AI on-prem, or are they just going to do it as a batch job on an off-prem mainframe? You know, head it up to Google, do the processing, extract the model, and then run that at the edge. It's not at all clear.
Right.
And there's months and months before anything starts. I would say it's still 2 or 3 years before AI reaches any sort of breakout, you know, usefulness, if I had to put a number on it now.
I guess we can put that proposition to the test because there's going to be a lot of AI in this episode of Network Break, and I feel like every episode lately. One thing I do want to mention is I did get briefed on Arista about the solution, and I feel like there was an opportunity where they could have slathered AI and ML all over this. They did not, so just a little tip of the marketing hat for that restraint there. It's appreciated. Links in the show notes if you want to read up on it. And I plan to write a blog on this Arista product as well, so there should be more details coming shortly, but we'll move on. Speaking of AI, Fortinet has announced new capabilities in its generative AI security assistance, including GenAI assisted scripting for CLI and Jinja templates. Fortinet says the assistant can help generate configurations, check for errors, and suggest corrections. The company has also launched a new GenAI assistant targeted at IoT and OT devices. Engineers can use natural language prompts to get information on IoT vulnerabilities and security levels. Of those vulnerabilities and see what users are associated with an IoT device and get recommendations on next steps.
So this feels like step by step from Fortinet, doesn't it?
Yep.
Drew, where you sort of get this, you know, there's an announcement, but it's not like this, you know, the fat lady sitting on the, you know, taking up the seat on the bus so that nobody else can jump into the market. This feels iterative and gradual, tentative, finding out what they can do, but also finding out what customers want. So rather than sort of taking something and having invested huge amounts of money into something and then expecting customers to buy it whether they like it or not, this feels much more iterative from Fortinet. So in this case, security AI assistance to help you generate CLI commands and Jinja templates, that's just an excellent use of AI. Why are you hand coding this? Why not get a Fortinet to do the work across their entire customer base for you? And then you can say, give me give me the CLI to be able to do this, you know, in a natural language query to a generative AI assistant, and it'll do it for you. And obviously Fortinet does it once and applies it to their 40,000 customers. So why would you want to do that any other way? And the same thing then applies to their assistant targeted at IoT and OT devices. I think for a help desk, this becomes much more valuable and useful, where your level one and level two people can be, you know, their ability to make changes to the system can be generated by an AI and perhaps validated by somebody or still goes through some sort of checks, but they can have a higher level of confidence that, you know, I'm going to make this change to the CLI. Maybe you only make these changes, you know, three or four times a year, Drew, and you forget the syntax in the middle, and right. Then you come back and you look at the syntax, you know, like,
yeah.
It just makes sense. So,
sure.
So I think that, again, these things are focused on security operations, right? And the focus here is a little unusual in that the first thing that they talk about is provisioning. So, you know, generating scripting based on conversational commands, plus it validates. So it scrutinizes the code that it creates for errors and suggests edits, streamlining code, and then enhancing the reliability of the configuration. So what Fortinet has done is taken a generative model to take your query, but the result that comes back is actually being validated in some way. So they're looking for, so just in case the code starts to hallucinate, they're making sure that it comes right. But they're also keeping a human in the pipeline. Now, what it struck me as I thought about keeping a human in the pipeline, Drew, there's a legal and liability aspect of this that unattended operations might be a consideration. That is, human liability is reasonably clear. If a human makes a mistake, your legal liability or your insurance liability is absolutely clear. Humans make mistakes, just one of those things. That's what you buy insurance for, right? Uh-huh. Nobody blames a human for making a reasonable and fair mistake. But what we are seeing at the moment is if you use an AI and it makes a reasonable and fair mistake, where do we sit legally or with a liability? And that is not yet clear. So I think for the time being, unless you can get an opinion from your corporate lawyer about where liability sits, keeping a human in the loop seems to make sense. Now, this applies to vendors and to customers and everyone in between. Does that make sense?
I mean, the vendors have done a fantastic job of essentially deflecting all liability, so I assume they'll be able to do the same with AI.
Yeah.
I don't know why it would be any different.
My worry here is that as people turn to AI, do they stop learning what's going on behind the scenes? So if you can just go to the AI and say, generate me a script for a CLI, do people stop learning the syntax? Maybe that's a conversation for another day or in a different, you know, on a different show on the network, on the podcast network. But it does seem to me that, you know, for now, this liability issue, and as we as customers and we as a society live with AI making changes or generating, you know, automated systems in a new way, until we sort of know what people will accept as a viable error is going to be something. Anyway, the other part about this, of course, is visibility and troubleshooting. They're doing AI analysis of available data to detect issues. The ability of an AI to sift through large amounts of data is obviously much better than human or superhuman. But I do, you know, it does obviously let the AI do the work in instead of people maintaining their skills or writing custom scripts or researching what it is. If you can just go to the AI and say, huh, is there anything wrong with this? And it to come back and says, no, maybe people get lazy and stop thinking about this. The other thing I'm thinking about, Drew, that this prompted me to start thinking about is, when will we see next generation firewalls with AI accelerators on board?
How do you mean?
I mean, if we're going to start doing AI processing, then there's some that we're going to do in a generative AI LLM, which can be done, you know, in a central controller, maybe on-prem, or whether it goes off to a cloud to generate those, you know, to handle those queries. But what happens when we start wanting to use an AI chip in the firewall to start real-time examination of the logic? We're already seeing desktop PCs come with artificial intelligence chips in them, right? So AI workstations. That's so that you can run AI models locally. I think we're going to see, this is just something that struck me as I was reading this, we're going to see firewalls and switches and SD-WAN devices and all that sort of stuff. They're going to have AI chips in them somewhere in the future.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess I assume so. I feel like how we're using AI is getting really squirrely here. But presumably they would be trained on, you know, threats that are relevant for this use case, as opposed to a generative AI kind of approach. So I feel like we're talking about different things in some ways.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this isn't generative AI. This is, I've got a model designed to detect threats firewall itself.
Sure, right? sure. Yes, so absolutely.
Microsecond, millisecond responses to a threat event. Is this a DDoS? Well, if you can, you know, if you're on a 100 gig pipe, you've probably got seconds to react, to identify it and react to that. Do you want to, you know, do you, and at some point, these companies who are running the AI models in the cloud, the cost of running this compute off-prem is actually starting to add up. So does it make more sense to delegate that power consumption down to the customer and put an AI chip down there and run the models externally, like, you know, at the edge?
I mean, I would assume you'd have to train the model in a big facility and then port that model onto a chip to do, you know, local inspection. I feel like we're talking about just sort of advanced inspection capabilities that you already get. You know, we've already got processors dedicated to security functions in a lot of these devices. And I anticipate that at some point someone will start stamping AI on them in the marketing sense. But I think more importantly,
the thing that strikes me is that the vendors are really stretching for a way to sell their hardware at the moment. And at some point it will become practical to put an AI, you know, processor or an AI engine or a GPU inside of all of our network appliances so that we can run AI agents or AI models locally on appliances.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. And then all of a sudden you've got a reason to go out and resell all of those switches, all those
2025, baby. Get ready to refresh that hardware.
Yeah.
Put it on the spreadsheet.
That's right. Yeah. So that's what struck me about this, is because I think there's two things happening here. One is, you know, or three things. One is the cost of running these models in the cloud. The vendors have to pay for that and pay for the power and the processing. So why not put that in the appliance? They can use that to drive an upgrade cycle down at the customer site. So I think there's a lot of incentive there, right, for vendors to say, you know, let's get an AI chipset inside of our next generation firewall and go out and tell all of our customers to buy the next version.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
Yes, yes.
We're not ready for that yet. I don't think you could go out there with a straight face say, you know, buy our AI ready firewall without having something to show for that. I think that's a marketing step too far. And so there's definitely an incentive, you know, for the vendors to get on board with that. So the extrapolation here is at some point you're going to see your AI enabled firewalls, switches, routers. I think it's coming. And when? Don't know, but I think you could expect that reasonably in the months to come.
I am very comfortable saying 2025 we'll start at least seeing marketing about it, whether or not you could prove it.
Sure. Yeah. There's too much money on the table. When you can resell the hardware, you've already sold it.
Oh, yes. Ooh, yes.
So much motivation.
So much money. All right, links in the show notes. We'll move on, but stick to AI. Versa Networks, they provide SD-WAN and SASE services. They've announced a Gen AI firewall. This is not a firewall that uses Gen AI. It's a firewall that, according to the press release, monitors, manages, and reports how an organization is consuming Gen AI services and applications. Versa says the firewall can help companies assess the risk of Gen AI applications, control access to those applications, and prevent unauthorized data movement. I couldn't find details on what this actually means because, I mean, if you don't want someone using ChatGPT, I presume you can just block that with a regular firewall. So I'm not sure if there's something more here, like some kind of maybe DLP element that lets you get more specific about the kinds of data you don't want getting out to Gen AI. But this is what Versa has announced.
Well, there is a market for that. So what we're seeing is especially financial companies are putting up AI firewalls to log what people are sending to the AI, to the offsite AIs. Mm-hmm. So some of the banking is actually disabling Microsoft Copilot and disabling the Bing AI mm-hmm. and ChatGPT because they don't want to be seen using AI and then the legal liability behind it. That's part of what was driving my commentary before mm-hmm. about, you know, the legal liabilities is the banks are very worried that if their staff start saying, generate me a spreadsheet to do a regressive cost analysis for a some complex financial instrument. Mm-hmm. And if it's wrong, who's liable? And the answer there gets very gray. And at this point, they're going to probably right. err on the side of caution. And say,
or if that sensitive information is getting out into a general AI that might get leaked somewhere else down the line.
Mm. But at the same time, these companies also want to use AI for things where it is adding value, automatically, you know, if you're trying to use a chatbot AI or something like that within the parameters of a useful chatbot, of which most of them aren't. I did see a useful chatbot this week, fast food stores. When you're in the drive-thru, they're starting to use chatbots there to take the order, uh-huh. right? Now, to me, that is a viable use because it's not like when you're in the queue at, you know, a Chew and Spew, it's not like they've got a vast portfolio of products that you need to select from. It's not like, you know, with the most complicated order you can have is I want my burger without tomato on it or whatever, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So to me, that's the chatbot that will actually work. It's limited in scope. The consequences of failure are small. And if needs be, you can just say, put me through to an operator and then somebody, you know, the person standing in the store will start to take your call, right?
Right, right.
So I'm not opposed to chatbots, but I think what we're seeing at the moment is chatbots being used in the wrong context. If you want to ring up and ask questions about your, you know, household insurance policy, probably not ready for that yet by comparison.
Yes. Yes.
So I think, you know, this type of AI firewall, there's a bunch of startups in this space and if Versa wants to get involved with that, I could see that's a viable market. What I don't see is how Versa's got the credibility to say that they've got the ability to do it. You know, if you turned up in front of a, you know, Fortune 500 CIO and said, hey, I'm an SD-WAN SASE company, I've got an AI firewall, is that interesting to you? And it's like, you know, credibility, where's the credibility there?
Sure, I can see that. Again, and I also am not clear on what they mean by a Gen AI firewall anyway, and how that differs from a regular firewall if I'm just trying to block access to, you know, public AI services. So
yeah, not a good... Not a good press release, doesn't really.
Yeah, and see if I can get more details.
Yeah. And the rest of it goes on about threat detection and data protection,
yeah.
anomaly detection and response, which is all basically, you know, at this point, that's all armpits, AI, you know, everybody's got armpits. Everybody's got an AI in the security space that's doing this. I guess the thing that I walked away from here, oh, and our good friend microsegmentation popped up, AI-powered adaptive software-defined microsegmentation, Drew. From Versa.
Okay, it's see, on the page there it is, when micro-segmentation.
Yeah, continually assessing user. So that's the same as what Arista was doing. So bang on trend with the micro-segmentation fashion right there. The question here is, again, what I said before, whether a company that has achieved modest success as a SASE company can rebrand as a genuine security company so that telcos and enterprises will buy products from them. So, and my case in point is F5 Networks. They've been attempting to do cybersecurity for going on 5 years now and not really getting much of a result with that at all. So your ability to stand up and say, hey, I'm in cybersecurity now, there are reasons here to challenge whether the reality is matches up with the words.
I guess I would say, based on what I've known of Versa, they have been in the security space for a while. So maybe they have built up enough credit. I mean, they're playing in SASE, which is a security offering. So obviously they have to have some of the tools if they're going to provide that kind of offering. Again, yeah, it's always a question when you're talking about security of credibility. Have you been around in the space long enough and demonstrated it? But I think the customers Versa's going after, which I think they actually work with a lot of service providers sort of reselling that service, makes sense for them. Because the service providers.
So my counter to that would be is that Palo Alto and Fortinet, for example, have made a good transition from being security companies to also being SASE companies.
Yes.
The question is, does it also go the other way?
Right.
And at this point, I don't think that's true.
Right. Well, we will see.
So we will see.
Yes. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, Palo Alto Networks. Your branches change, your SD-WAN should too. Palo Alto Networks wants to show you how AI and ML are powering next-gen SD-WAN and SASE for the branch. SDX Central and Palo Alto Networks hosted an exclusive online event that shows how next-gen SD-WAN and SASE can help you modernize and secure your branches. Go to sdxcentral.com to get the link to this free event to see the replay or find the link to it in the show notes for Network Break 477. Back to the news. Amazon Web Services will no longer resell VMware Cloud on AWS. You can still get VMware Cloud on AWS, but apparently you have to go through Broadcom instead of AWS. AWS has set up a portal for customers who might want to migrate off to AWS's own EC2 or EKS services.
Yeah, this was a topic du jour, shall we say, Drew, on the Twitters and the Reddits and various other social media forums. Mm-hmm. And this took me a while to iterate to where I am now. And to date, VMware has not released an official statement one way or the other. But the first rumor emerged that AWS was releasing all of the team that was associated with VMware Cloud on AWS, mm-hmm. and that this would happen by the 1st of May. I haven't seen any confirmation one way or the other. And then the VMware page, the VMware landing page on the AWS site, has simply how to migrate from VMware Cloud to AWS, which is a bit cheeky, right? Sure. And so if you're looking at this, you might think, you know, AWS and VMware have fallen out and they're not doing anything. And if so, but when you scratch away at it, here's where I think we're at, Drew. So VMware's cloud on AWS is no longer being run by AWS. AWS used to cooperatively engage with VMware to do this.
Okay.
And AWS has now decided that for whatever reason, not to do this. And I think partly because VMware's changing the licensing, this idea of license portability, and the only place that you buy VMware licenses is from VMware or through VMware's reseller. You can't buy VMware licenses from AWS anymore, which is part of that agreement. Mm-hmm. Before, when you had VMware Cloud on AWS, you could buy the licenses and then it would run on top of this. My belief is that because AWS is not a reseller, customers can bring their licenses from wherever. So AWS is actually no longer involved in this. So VMware is now running VMware Cloud on AWS. The portal that manages the VMware Cloud on AWS is run by VMware staffers somewhere outside of AWS. And AWS itself has nothing to do with it, and nor does it need to. The only thing that the customer has, relationship the customer has with AWS, is paying the bill for the servers and the storage and the networking and all of the functions in AWS that you use. That stays, as I understand it, on your bill. And because so now what you have is VMware Cloud on AWS continues just like it always has. There is a transition. My understanding is that the VMware Cloud that's on AWS is not VMware Cloud Foundation. So there's a series of migrations coming up to make it run the same code as everything else, but that's yet to come. And that's only my belief. I'm not confirming that one way or the other. But the official line from various people is, you know, it's continuing on, it's got full support, there's a road mirror features, it's run by VMware on Broadcom, and the only thing that's changed is you can't buy it through AWS anymore. Hence, the VMware landing page just says, why don't you migrate to AWS? So that's what I believe is happening. I don't believe that, you know, AWS has particularly had a falling out with VMware. It's just that the new model means that there are changes in the way the licensing is. And, you know, I suspect that AWS would want to have sold those licenses, but Broadcom doesn't want to give them a most favored nation clause. AWS and Amazon always says, if you sell something to us, you have to give us the best pricing mm-hmm. out of everybody, mm-hmm. or at least the same pricing as everybody else, which automatically means that AWS is the cheapest, you know, the best source for that sort of thing quite often.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure that Broadcom didn't want to see that happen. You know, so maybe that's where the confusion comes in.
I mean, the whole VMware disposition has been very confusing with Broadcom. And this is, I think, just another data point there.
So two things. One is, obviously, if you go to the VMware site and look at press releases, they stopped releasing press releases in March. So that's it. Like, that was the end of that. So we don't get any information from there. I did reach out to people at VMware. They have a statement in the works, but it won't be released until, I believe, later today. Today is Friday. And so perhaps we'll have something for you next week, or you'll see something in the general press shortly.
Yeah. All right, moving on. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission is asking Congress for $3 billion to help telcos and service providers remove Huawei and ZTE gear from those networks. Congress mandated the removal of Chinese-made telecom gear over concerns about national security. However, regional and rural telcos are struggling with the high costs of replacing the equipment, and some areas are going without service. For instance, the Washington Post reports that one small wireless provider in Tennessee has only received about $24 million of the estimated $181 million needed to replace the equipment, and the parts of that telco's network aren't operating while they wait for the money.
If there's a credible case for government grants to telcos, then rural telcos, in my view, is generally where they need to go.
Yes, right? Yeah, for sure.
Telcos get huge amount of government support in all the countries around the world, but U.S. telcos have been very good at regulatory capture. They captured the government to give them money for nothing in
certainly
many cases.
Certainly the big ones, yeah.
Certainly the big ones, right? And the rural telcos who exist should definitely be encouraged to create a competitive environment, in my not very experienced view, but that applies everywhere, Europe, UK, Australia, whatever, right? And we've seen consistent value every time the government steps in to support smaller telcos and to provide competitive environments, the bigger telcos have had to respond, and there's been positives in there for customers around the world. So the rural telcos just don't have the business size or the number of customers, and increasingly the rural areas are where the big telcos consider, shall we say, what's the value of spending money in a sparsely populated area? So,
right.
You know, customers per square kilometer is a key metric for telcos. And the more customers per square kilometer means the more profits you can generate for the infrastructure that you've deployed on the ground. So if you're switching out cheap Huawei equipment and you've been forced to turn it off, you know, because national security, it's certainly, in my view, going to hurt rural telcos more. And it seems reasonable to go back to the government and say, look, you did mandate switching off this company, you know, this equipment for these reasons. Reasonable, not a free handout, right?
No, yeah, I tend to roll my eyes if the big telcos or service providers have their handout. But for this constituency, it's small, rural and regional providers. They're being required to meet a mandate that the government put on them. It does seem warranted to say, okay, well, you got to help us out here because this stuff's expensive and we can't just not have this network generating revenue while we, you know, as we're ripping this gear out or waiting for you to subsidize it. So I think it's an entirely reasonable ask. And since it was a government mandate, the government should pony up here.
Yeah. And, you know, rural telcos often run on profit margins far less than what the mainstream telcos get,
absolutely,
like the major telcos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The reason they exist is because the mainstream telcos don't want to be in that market.
Right, right.
Most often. So,
yes, you know. Yes. And also just a note to anyone from, you know, Cisco, Nokia, Ericsson, Juniper, et cetera, who might be listening, you know, you've got high-priced lobbyists. Get them to work here. There's opportunity on this. So make those phone calls. Mm. Our last story for the day, Fortinet released results for their Q1 2024 fiscal quarter. Revenues were $1.35 billion, up 7.2%, with net income of $299 million, up over this time last year. Although its billings estimate for the coming second quarter results were below Wall Street expectations, which did knock the share price down about 8% on the news.
Yeah, the knockdown, you know, this is where I'm talking about this sentiment that's coming back on the in the market, saying that unless you're NVIDIA class asset, you know, which is a once in a decade opportunity, right? I think that people are sort of, there's definitely a sort of sentiment running against the tech stocks, and we've seen a sort of a general trend against them. I'm less interested in the results because it's, you know, Fortinet's doing fine. $1.3 billion, up 7.2% with a net income of $200 or $300 million. That's pretty great.
That's
right?
Nice. Yep.
And the share price, you know, probably has been speculating ahead of it. It's the investor presentation that got me really interested. They broke down they regard three segments of their business: secure networking, which is more or less firewalls or cybersecurity, is 67% of their business, and SASE is 24% of their business. And security operations, that's 40 Analyzer, 40 SIEM, 40 Sandbox, you know, all the other 40s, 40 Recon, you know, all the SOC stuff, is 9%. I think that's significant. 24% of the business to be SASE after, Drew, what, 6 or 7 years? That's a significant business to build, and then also to turn themselves away from just a firewall company to a security operations company to follow that SOC as a service type trend and produce tools that SOCs use, to make that nearly 10% of the company is also significant. Does that feel the same to you?
Well, I'm curious about that, you know, 24% is unified SASE because that SASE also includes SD-WAN. So I'm curious to know how much of that is actually pure SASE versus the SD-WAN business. My guess is SD-WAN accounts for a lot of that 24% without the cloud security element attached to it. So I'd be curious to see that breakout. But yes, I do agree generally that building that business to 24% of your revenue or your billings anyway, in the relatively short period of time that the SASE notion has been around is pretty good and indication of where the security market seems to be going. Although still a hefty chunk of their money is coming from traditional firewalls, which is to be expected. And I you would say the same thing about Checkpoint, Palo, et cetera.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to sort of have a look at Palo and see where their breakdown is, how much of theirs is, you know, maybe we'll do that when their financial announcements come out, if they start publishing the breakdowns. A lot of companies aren't publishing these breakdowns anymore so that you can't know, you can't understand. The other thing I noted in their financial results is their revenue by geography. America is 40% of their total revenue. EMEA is 40% and APAC is 20%. That's unusual that for a company where basically the US and EMEA or the Americas and EMEA are roughly the same size. Most of the cybersecurity vendors are over heavy in the US market. And it's not something that I was aware of before, but Fortinet is really a global player. They're not just a US company, such as what we see from, say, Palo Alto, for example, or Versa. They are very much, you know, those types of companies are very US-centric. Whereas Fortinet is very, you know, well distributed across the world.
That is pretty well balanced and not what I would have guessed, yeah.
Yeah, surprising to me. I would have thought 20% in EMEA and 10% in APAC or 25, 10, something like that. Mm-hmm. But no, they've got a very substantial business in Europe. So they are very much a global company. And I wonder if that puts them in, I don't know, just makes me think whether they're in a better position long-term or not. It's not clear to me whether that's a viable conclusion to draw. But, you know, just interesting to sort of break it down and see how much money they're making out of just firewalls and then out of SaaS and then out of security operations. And know that, you know, there's still plenty of room for growth in SaaS. As they say, the universal SaaS market is $21 billion. It's growing at 20% per annum. So they're basically saying that they will continue to grow with that. And security operations, interestingly, is a $60 billion market growing at 13% per annum. And I think Fortinet sees that security operations as where they're going. You know, we've seen them so much stuff around the AI and so forth, getting security operations under control. And I think also that's about customer control. If you can be embedded in their security operations and helping them with the day-to-day operations with tools and things like that, that's actually a massive way to reach your customers and maintain control of what they're doing and what your tooling that goes with it.
Yeah, absolutely agree. That's a growth area. Everybody who needs security tools has the security tools. The value proposition is really going to come from what do you do with the just gobs and gobs of information being spit out by these tools. You need mechanisms to actually get some signal from all that noise, and a good security operations infrastructure can do that. So yeah, it's a great opportunity for customer control.
But there's so many tools. I mean, you know, look at this 40 SOC, 40, you know, yes, the SIEM,
SOAR, you've got SIEM, your thread, NDR, you've got your XDR, et cetera, et cetera.
All these things, you do all this on Packet Protector on the podcast you do with JJ, right? Mm-hmm. Bringing all that together into some sort of unified sanity, sane, you know, where you can, you know, you don't have to jump from tool to tool to try and build up some image of what's happening. I think that is a growth market.
So. Yeah. Well, the dirty secret is there probably is no sanity, but that's a different episode.
Yeah, probably not. No.
Yeah. But it's, you know, that's what we're headed toward. I'm looking for that.
We can aim. We can try.
We're aiming.
We can strive. Strive.
We all need a goal. All right, that wraps up the news portion. Please do stick around for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with NetBees. We're going to be talking about real-time network performance monitoring. That's coming right up. Today on the Tech Bytes podcast, we talk monitoring. Network monitoring is a perpetual issue for network engineers because you know that anytime an application is slow or a Zoom call is glitchy, someone's going to fire off a ticket that says the network isn't working. And monitoring is getting increasingly complicated by distributed workers and distributed applications. So when that ticket comes in, you're going to need good data and the right data to diagnose and solve problems. Our sponsor NetBees offers products for monitoring critical segments, including network performance, Wi-Fi, and end users. My guest is Stefano Gridelli, co-founder and CEO of NetBees. Stefano, welcome back to Packet Pushers, and let's start with a quick background on NetBees.
Hey, Drew, nice to be here. NetBeez is a real-time network performance monitoring solution that runs end-to-end tests on any network infrastructure, whether that's on-prem, cloud, or remote.
Okay, so what's the difference then between, you know, what I would get with NetBeez and sort of what I'm thinking of traditional monitoring techniques?
Traditional monitoring, when we say that, we think more about SNMP monitoring. So network device polling with SNMP get and so on. And that's a, you know, much needed resource to understand the status of the network devices. However, they don't really tell you whether the network is working for the end users and your applications. And that's what NetBeez aims to do, is to provide end-to-end active network monitoring by running basic synthetic transaction or network testing across your network and against applications or services.
Okay, so I think that's an important distinction then. What do you mean by active monitoring? I guess I'm getting a sense there with the synthetic testing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also in opposition with passive network monitoring or performance monitoring, where you generally listen or collect passively stats about what's going on your network. Active network monitoring actually is a continuous, basically testing 24/7. So we run things like ping tests, DNS queries, trace route path analysis, and throughput tests, for instance, really to get that understanding of the performance at any place and time in a network. And that's very important to be proactive, to detect problem when things break without relying on user traffic to gather that information.
Got it. So synthetic means I can control when I want to do the test, I can control what kind of tests, and I know I'm getting regular information back to the NetBeez system, which is then, I presume, doing some kind of an analysis to build baselines and so on and give me deviations and alerts.
Exactly, precisely. And just also to kind of estimate the end user experience on the network in the end, because in the end, users are sending or receiving packets in a simple way.
Right. So how would I deploy NetBeez? Is there hardware? Is this SaaS? How does it work?
Yeah, so NetBeez works by deploying hardware or software network monitoring appliances that are distributed around a network. You know, we support from hardware-based appliances, say, for Wi-Fi monitoring to Docker or VMs. Those actually are also used by leading routing and switching vendors such as Cisco or Extreme to run application hosting on their switches or routers. And then we also have, Linux packages, if preferred. So really, you can have a full coverage on your on-prem, remote, or cloud network. And then we have another set of agents, which are software clients, very lightweight, that run on end-user desktops or laptop. And those are like NetBeez agents that run tests and gather understanding of the end-user experience.
Okay, so if I've got remote workers and I want to get a sense of the performance they're getting, I can put an agent onto their laptops and that reports back to another sensor somewhere?
No, great question. So the controller, the main brain, are not the agents, which are like a simple units that do testing, but it's actually the central server that accesses the controller, the data repository, and the dashboard. So all the agents will report back to the controller, which kind of rules them all, and then with which the network engineer or admin interacts with.
Got it. Okay. Does the hardware also connect up to the controllers?
Yeah, they are all, on that sense, they all work the same way. They connect to the server as soon as they're plugged in or installed in a network or location or laptop. Yeah.
And you mentioned cloud, that I can do cloud monitoring. Do you mean like if I'm using, public cloud infrastructure as a service, I can deploy a software agent in like a VPC or something or something else? What are you thinking when you say cloud?
Yeah, that is correct. So there are two options. You can deploy an instance on AWS or any other, cloud, as long as you have an Ubuntu or a Debian, say, operating system available. So you can deploy as an image or as a Linux, Debian, or Ubuntu package with apt-get installed, for instance. And then you have basically a footprint in your cloud, and then from that agent you can run all sorts of tests, active tests, to other cloud regions, applications, if you want to also include external monitoring in your dashboard, or to your on-prem destination networks through an express route or a VPN link, and understand what is the cloud to on-prem and vice versa performance, which is very important.
That's an interesting point, because as people are adopting cloud more, I assume AWS is going to give me maybe fairly decent metrics on the performance inside AWS, but then there's maybe blind spots between my on-prem and AWS.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, AWS, like any other cloud provider, they give you kind of the SNMP view, what we call it. They give you like the, you know, resources, utilization and status of your instances, but they don't give you that active end-to-end telemetry from any VPC to any other destination network.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So I can get more granular active details.
Yeah, exactly. So at least you can, I think the base thing that you want to cover is how is my latency and packet loss to destination networks that are very important to me, because things like latency and packet loss seems very simple, right, to describe, but to obtain at scale, nobody has that information. And that information will give you an understanding how good or bad could be potentially your network connection to that environment, to and from.
And when I'm looking at the NetBees dashboard, can you give me a sense of what I'm getting?
Yeah. So the dashboard is organized in different tabs to manage your agents, for instance, interact with the agents. You have a section for targets to create targets, which targets are any application or resource, could be also a destination network that you want the agents to monitor. So we also have SaaS templates, for instance, you know, Microsoft Office or, you know, Google Workspace, for instance. Mm-hmm. So you create a target, you assign agents to this target, and the targets define the set of tests that will be run to monitor that resource. And from that moment on, you gather the information on the target. So the target is very important also to compare performance across agents. And then, you know, on top of that, there are sections to run schedule tests, things like Hyper for throughput or network speed for download and upload speed. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have reporting and, NOC dashboard as well, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Got it. So we touched on sort of the three big use cases for NetBees. Let's just go through each one of them very quickly.
Yeah. So originally when we started NetBees, it was mostly for on-prem network or internal network monitoring. So our goal was to help medium and large size, highly distributed organizations that have many remote branches, a pretty large wider network. And those would be a hardware-based or VMs, appliances that you install around this network. Then from that, we evolved and we also included Wi-Fi network monitoring, meaning that now the little probe, at least the harder one, is also equipped with a Wi-Fi interface, so we can understand not just the wired infrastructure performance, but also how is the corporate wireless network? Can it authenticate users, you know, with radios? How long does it take to connect to the network? And then the same test that you can run on the wired, also on the wireless with ping, DNS, HTTP, and so on, including download upload speed and Hyper, for instance. Then, 2020, as you know, everybody had to work from home and we decided to, try to basically port the NetBees agent to a small lightweight client for Windows and Mac, which we did. And now we also offer the ability to monitor not just your kind of on-prem network, not your Wi-Fi, but also your work from home users. And actually now we basically cover all these three use cases pretty well. So also now with the, hybrid work, employees might work some days at home, some days at the office, with the agent that runs on their desktop or laptops that follows them, you can understand how is their performance, especially when they work from home. And you can understand things like, is it maybe my SP not giving me enough bandwidth, or the latency and packet loss is pretty bad, or maybe my home wireless is not exactly designed for me to, to be too much on voice and videos, collaboration tools and so on. Mm-hmm.
So you can measure the performance I'm getting from the PC essentially to my wireless router, you're saying?
Yeah, precisely. So, the endpoint performance, CPU and memory, we report the Wi-Fi metrics, understand how good is the signal coverage, or if there is noise from maybe neighbor's network, you can do an SSID scan remotely, understand the download and upload speed. And then, of course, connectivity to your SaaS with the target monitoring. and trace running path analysis analytics for internet performance. So as a result, that agent is very important because some organization they don't care too much what's your network performance at home, because if you work from home, we don't support it. But others, it's very important because actually some organization did the conscious decision to really be a remote company. So for those employees, they have to grant good performance and make sure they're productive. And this is a very good way to, have real data, quantitative data to understand what issues they're facing and what is the best resolution for those remote users. And that is a big time saver because you don't need to maybe do a remote desktop. You don't need to maybe interact with the user and try to figure out what they're doing. It's a very time consuming effort if you don't have some tooling that allows you to collect that information.
Well, that's probably a good time then to, you've got some customer examples of folks who are actually using NetBees in production. And one of the examples was this remote worker scenario. So can you talk us through what this customer is doing?
Yeah, so this customer is a financial services company with they made the decision actually before COVID to basically move all their contact center agents to work from home. And in this these employees, their task is to take basically 800 calls to assist their customers via phone call. Yep. And what they realize is like with 19,000 remote contact center agents, there are a lot of tickets that on a daily basis hits their help desk team. And some of those tickets are easily handled by the level one, but some others are escalated to the level three. And that's a lot time consuming effort to understand particularly what is their problem.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure people got that number, 19,000 remote users.
Yeah, 19,000. So what NetBees helps them is really understand at scale what is the performance of these users and prioritize the kind of, I would say, the one that are having a bad issues with the voice and video, because think about they need to have a very good voice performance. So
for sure,
latency and packet loss needs to stay under certain limits and jitter and so on. So the data they can gather from the dashboard, they can really understand who are the the remote contact center agents that are experiencing the most problems, and help them basically fix their problems, which could be open a ticket with the ISP, or could be maybe temporarily remove them from the inbound queue so they don't have, they don't provide, a choppy voice, or their help is effective and not like degraded by the voice experience.
So what kind of troubleshooting can, a network engineer do when they're getting this information from this agent?
Yeah, so first of all, do fault isolation. They can quickly understand what they're dealing with. Oftentimes, the most common problems are the internet service provider, but of course, to come to that conclusion, you need to have the data. So ISP is the number one, followed by VPN and also the home Wi-Fi.
Right.
So we saw some organization, they kind of ask their remote users to work wired to the router, so they remove at least the Wi-Fi, but they still deal with ISP performance issues or VPN issues. So the nice thing is that you can also get a pretty good reporting on ISP performance and understand good from bad ISP. And in some areas where there are, there is not a monopoly, there are multiple options, they can switch to the best plan or upgrade their ISP plan to one that meets their SLAs.
Got it. Okay. And then there's also a customer who's using you for Wi-Fi monitoring.
So Wi-Fi monitoring is also that a pretty popular use case with our user base. We see especially in the higher education and also healthcare. There is a Wi-Fi is everything. It's the workhorse. So in those environments, very dynamic and very dense in some areas, they really need to understand, first of all, at the basic level, if the service is available. So our sensor provides a client perspective into the connection to the network. And then they provide also, of course, understanding of performance at the network level. But in some areas where maybe a lot of users congregate, that's where maybe when there are performance issues, they can also deploy a probe ad hoc if needed, unless they have a permanent sensor installed there. So it's really like a very good way to save time from driving to a remote location and having yourself to sit and wait some time for the problem to occur. Another feature that we provide capabilities like a remote packet capture, as that also pretty important when you have, you know, driver issues between a specific client vendor and, you know, a networking vendor.
So your appliance can kick off a packet capture?
Yes, correct. That's what we call an ad hoc test, meaning that the user on the dashboard starts the packet capture and then collects the pickup at the end of the session.
And this, again, I guess, requires your hardware then to do the Wi-Fi monitoring?
Yeah, so for that, we provide the hardware, although for the rest, we tap on common platform like Linux, Docker, or even the Raspberry Pi. Mm-hmm. But for the Wi-Fi, because of, you know, there is not just a Raspberry Pi behind, there is so we provide a hardware probe for that.
Okay, because you need a wireless NIC in there.
Exactly, yeah, you cannot virtualize that, unfortunately. Not yet, who knows.
And then last but not least is sort of where you started with the network performance monitoring, and you've got a customer story there.
Yeah, exactly. So network performance is, you know, any company with a pretty distributed network, sometimes even global footprint, they really rely on the sensors, whether are hardware. Now it's actually more application hosting, which is very good because you don't need to support an extra piece of hardware. But for them, it's very important to understand performance end-to-end. Are those remote locations up, meaning that they can even connect to either the data center or the cloud, and what's their performance? With SD-WAN, when there is direct internet access for those remote locations, it's more difficult to understand what's their internet performance. So that really helps having a remote agent out there. But also outside, you know, a distributed organization, also small and large telcos use our probes to understand the customer subscriber experience. And they might install some time at a subscriber home, which could be a business or a home user, or sometime in aggregation points for multiple subscribers.
So they would put one of your devices at, say, a big customer's site to make sure that they're getting the performance they're paying for?
Exactly, yeah. Some small regional ISP would also deploy it on, you know, a kind of private subscriber. But generally, yeah, it's more the business user, the business subscribers in that case.
Now, you mentioned SD-WAN. Where do you see a use case for NetBees there? Because my understanding of SD-WAN is that they're already essentially doing a lot of that monitoring of the links.
Yeah, they do actually. But what they mostly focus is the last mile. They need to, of course, understand what is the performance of each or underlying network and connection to then optimize and do their, you know, per flow, per packet decision. But they don't really do an end-to-end type of performance. So on that, NetBees is more kind of end-to-end. And it's also like a vendor independent. So you have like...
you want the belt and suspenders.
So yeah, it's definitely like a SD-WAN doesn't replace really active network monitoring, although to a certain extent they implement some function of it to solve their function. But their SD-WAN is not meant to replace generally, you know, distributed network monitoring.
Okay, so if I've got sort of some critical branches and I want to make sure that end-to-end performance is good and I want that active monitoring capability, I can sort of supplement the metrics I'm getting from SD-WAN with NetBees.
Yes, that is correct. And think that this is active monitoring traffic, so 24/7. We don't rely on passive data. So if there are no users, you don't know if the network is actually, you know, can then yes. route and, you know, forward their traffic. So you always want to have like a canary in the mine to give you proactiveness and notification if something is breaking, perhaps after a configuration change. I've been there many times, and traditionally what I would do before NetBees was open a bunch of terminals when I had to do a routing change or a change in, you know, VLAN and so on. Mm-hmm. I would make sure that my ping then would come back, right? Mm-hmm. Now I would do that with, and our customers do that with NetBees. So they have already like their full mesh of ping test or other connectivity test. And before and after a configuration change, you want to make sure that you see green, basically.
Got it. So you can actually integrate right into the workflow, even when there are changes, not just monitoring performance, but can I even reach the site?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, that's great. Okay, Stefano, I think we can squeeze in one more question here. Obviously, you know, NetBees doesn't live alone in the network operations environment. Do you have ways to integrate with other systems? Do you have APIs if there's other systems I want to get your data out of or for you to communicate to?
Yeah, so we support the JSON API on api.netbees.net. You can see the Postman kind of documentation. We have webhooks, but then we support standard protocols and third-party integrations, such as with ServiceNow, Microsoft Teams, and so on. So the long story short is that we coexist with other tools, and it's easily integratable with an escalation in terms of support and also other monitoring tools.
All right. Well, if folks want to dig into NetBeez for themselves, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to netbeez.net, and that they can request a new demo or even a web trial and learn more about us.
And I think you also have a NetBeez landing page, right, with netbeez.net/packetpushers?
Correct. netbeez.net/packetpushers.
All right. That's NetBeez, NetBeez.net, netbeez.net, and also check out netbeez.net/packetpushers. Thanks to Fano for being here and to NetBeez for being a sponsor. And as always, thank you for listening. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts and our community blog. It's all at packetpushers.net. You can join our Slack community, hear us on Spotify, rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.